opening this hearing of the House Committee on Revenue, February 7th. We have four public hearings scheduled, and for those of you here or watching, we may be changing the order on the agenda. We will definitely begin with House Bill 2458 as printed on the agenda. But the bills after that may be slightly out of order depending on who's available, who's still trying to make it here from a traffic tie-up on I-5 southbound. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2458.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2458 is a property tax bill. It's relating, it would, create an exemption from ad valorem property taxation for property that is owned or used by a cooperative for purpose of providing steam or hot water heat by combustion of biomass. And this would only apply to cooperatives whose property is subject to central assessment and if 50% of the interest in the co-op is owned by a exempt state or local government property tax entity.
Thank you. Representative Findley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Lynn Findley. I represent House District 60, which serves Grant, Harney, Baker, Malheur, and part of Lake County. I'm happy to say I have some incredible Harney County residents here to provide detailed testimony on this bill. And I believe we have Judge Pete Reynolds, the Harney County judge, on the phone, so he can join us as well. So I'll briefly give you an introduction to what we're doing, and I'll turn it over to the people that really know what the heck they're talking about. So House Bill 2458 provides property tax exemption to cooperatives providing steam or hot water for the purpose of heating public facilities and others. Several years ago, Harney County developed a project in cooperation with the county and the school districts to provide, to reduce biomass from the forest, produce hot water. This is a very specific property tax exemption for companies that provides hot water or steam for these purposes. It can apply to other areas. I mean, I think this technology is well proven, and as it becomes aged, as we got through the process in Harney County, they ran into a little bump with property taxes. They thought they had the proper forms filled out, which they did. They got their IRS tax exemption status, and they had a little bump in the road with the Department of Revenue. So this is a fix for that process. So at this point, I'd like to turn over to Lori Cheeks, and you can continue from there.
Good morning, and thank you very much for allowing us to come down here and talk to you. This is the second or third trip that we've been down here, and I so appreciate we live a long ways away. We basically are a frontier county, in my opinion. We live 130 miles from anybody, except, including Vail, 125. Oh, I'm Lori Cheek. I am so sorry. I am the vice president of the High Desert Biomass Cooperative. And I started this process in 2014 when we had a 74-year-old boiler in the biggest school in Harney County, Harney County District 3 school district, that was failing very badly and costing a lot of money just to keep running. It was a diesel boiler. We were freezing pipes. The kids wore boots, coats, and gloves in our school because we could not control the heat. At the same time, I work for the county. I'm the director of the juvenile department, and the biomass or the boiler at the courthouse was being condemned in 2016. So we asked a developer to come in. The developer was Andrew Hayden from Wisewood. He wanted to sell us pellet boilers. I recommended that. There was a pellet mill up in Malheur County. John Day, Grant County. We didn't want to have anything but a hog fuel, which is basically yard debris. People chip up their yard debris. That's exactly what we do have. However, that technology wasn't available in the U.S. other than to produce electricity. Had a lot of experience with that because I came out of the mill. We asked him to go and find it. He came back in 2015. He found it. It was in Austria. It is a very different type of heating. It is heating that is controlled electronically. European development is very different. If they need one pump, they have two. We have two, we have a biomass boiler that has two fires. We have, everything is duplicate. It costs more money. The technology is much more advanced. However, it is durable. It is easy to control. Last year, we had a very bad windstorm that occurred on May 25th in Harney County, and it blew a lot of huge poplar trees, fir trees, all over, knocked lines down and everything. We opened our gates to our log yard to allow the cities to load it up on their trucks, get it out of the ditches, get the lines back up, and that is what we're burning this year. We are burning the wind blow down from last May, which is, it saved the community money and it gave us basically free chips. It's been a little different because it's a different mix. We believe that we are working with several different people, including Tree Service, which has got a contract with OTEC to get all of their debris that they cut out along the electrical lanes and also danger logs along the highways. And we're going to be using that. We have a deal with him that he delivers it to our log. He doesn't have to pay for storing it there or as he does waste in other areas. And then we grind it up. We could take total yard debris, branches, leaves, and trees. This is our second year. We formed the co-op in 2015. There was bumps in the road. We are now heating a 6-block area. It is from our school down to the courthouse, a mental health and drug treatment center, St. Andrew's Church. And we did a feasibility study. We are going to expand down to the downtown area with some businesses. We appreciate that the state was willing to listen to us, and Representative Finley was very welcoming to us. He also asked us questions about, help him to understand exactly what we're doing. The importance of this law isn't just to us. There are other counties that are reaching out to us that would love to do this because they have to take care of themselves. There's no industry that's going to come in and do it for them. So thank you so very much. I really, truly appreciate it. And I hope you know that Harney County does.
Thank you.
I'm Lisa King. I'm current board chair of the Harney District 3 School Board and also secretary on the biomass co-op board as well. To be real honest, a couple years ago when Lori asked me to be on the biomass board, I was a little overwhelmed. How are we going to get this done? It was a big task. But rather than talking about all the reasons we couldn't work together and the reasons that would stand in our way, there were a lot of what-if conversations. And this project definitely morphed into something larger than what it was originally going to be for. The solution for just those two buildings. All of which came by, again, the what-if conversations. What if we bring this technology? What if we expand down here? Of course, this measure is going to benefit us, but it's also has the potential to start those conversations with other rural counties. They can start their what-if conversations and try and bring some community members together to a reason for them to get to work together and try and make a solution for something. So it has a lot of potential.
Thank you. And also signed up to testify, as you mentioned, Representative, is Judge Pete Runnels. Is the judge prepared?
He's up in the suit.
He's in the suit.
There's something.
Perhaps not.
Got it. It's Harney County, you know.
I know.
Hello.
Hello. Is this Judge Runnels?
Yes, it is.
Hello. This is Nancy Nathanson chairing the House Committee on Revenue, and Representative Findley is here with us, as well as several other people. I understand you would like to testify this morning on House Bill 2458.
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair Nathanson. Sorry, apologies I couldn't be there in person, but big meeting in town last night. So I would like to make a couple comments on HB 2458, some of the situations we found ourselves in after we this biomass heating district was created, basically being 90% owned by public, that being the Harney County Courthouse Court and the school district. And in reference to 307.090, we felt we truly fit under that heading. However, it only refers to electric utility properties and not the hot water biomass heating that this was created for. Felt that missing in the statutes is a true definition of hot water or biomass that is used for hot water to heat facilities. There is no production of energy, which we kind of got tied up into, twisted into. It is actually only for the purpose of heating. There's no resale value to it. And it's been a very positive venture for our community. We're heating 3.5 city blocks of businesses at this time. Hopes to expand, but we got caught up in this not being exempt from the taxes, and it really put a crinkle to our to our venture.
Thank you. Are there, excuse me, are there questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for being here, and thank you, Judge, for being on the phone. So I just want to make sure I kind of understand what we're talking about here. So you invested in this boiler, which allows you to convert biomass broadly into steam heat. So that boiler exists and it is heating the school, and now it is heating like a six block area. Is
yes.
It, I guess I'm just trying to get a sense of kind of how that works and then what the property tax exemption is being sought on. Is it the school where the boiler is? Is it where the boiler is? Is it all of the properties that the boiler is heating? If you could just kind of talk me through that.
The boiler is owned completely by the city or the county and the school. So it's owned by public entities. We expanded to include other people that were willing to convert to this because I'm sure you guys know every gallon of diesel, every gallon of gas and propane, we don't have natural gas, are driven in, hence more pollution and also more cost. Mm-hmm. There was some people, a church and a addictions mental health division within a block of us, plus the jail and the sheriff's office, that used boilers that we could just receive hot water. The steam is used at the school, so the boiler is on school property. The only thing that is in the public, it's in the by the sewer lines, it's the utility lines. We put pipe in there. That is all that is on public. It's not on anybody's property other than the school. The school leases the boiler that is on school property. They lease the property to the co-op for $1 a year. But it was developed by a private firm. Because we certainly couldn't go over and find it. When it was being built and developed, before it was basically what we refer to as turnkey, they worked it out, kept working on it for a period of about 2 years, starting in 2015 and completing when we bought it in October of 2017. We were nonprofit. We believed that we would not pay any form of property tax. We were on a tight budget too. Myers Memorial backed our energy efficient tax credits that we got in a 5 year instead of a payout. And then we had a loan with Craft 3 Bank, which is a nonprofit bank. when we had that, our money was very, very tight. There's really no employees, although there is now. We are hiring a boiler tech now. That caused a huge problem for us, and we filed a nonprofit exemption with the state to ask that we not be taxed because we're a nonprofit. It was a dangerous road. We did pay taxes last year. It was about, I don't know, $40,000, which hurt us a lot, but we paid it. This year, we are trying to get out from under that, and it's going to enable us to extend that pipe down to the downtown in the utility underneath the pavement. We did also get six blocks paved as part of this through an ODOT grant, so we left the roads in very good shape. But we can expand. We have about 40% more to produce, to sell. I mean, that we're just rounding. It's a big loop, and the hot water goes down, and it goes into these radiant systems and through the buildings, and then it goes back to the school.
So if I may, Rep. Smith, Chair Nathanson, the operation of this is a corporation, a nonprofit corporation. And the current code, and the LRO staff can help with that, is in statute does not allow, only allows for companies that will generate electricity to be nonprofit.
Right.
So this is a fix for that. This the public entity side of this is to operate the steam generation to produce hot water for heating systems, and the code does not recognize steam generation for hot water purposes. The code only recognizes power generation.
Gotcha.
And this is amending the code to allow the operation of this system. It is not for public profit. They are mostly public entities that it works, but while they run down into become efficiencies and help pay the bills, they've attached them. But the majority of it is public entities. So does that answer your question?
That helps, yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
LRO, do you have anything to add to the helping us understand the specific technical question that the representative had?
Madam Chair, I believe the Department of Revenue can speak to the particulars of this case, but no, in terms of a general description, I think Representative Finley did a really excellent job of explaining how the statute can exempt some things and not grab necessarily everything.
Okay, good.
Madam Chair, I may add, typically, as you recall, I take specific exception to any time that this committee grants property tax exemptions because it's a taxing district in a local area that we're spending those dollars. This was generated from that taxing district. Judge P. Reynolds and they are fully supportive of this effort. So the Department of Revenue helped craft this bill and the legislative concept, so they're supportive of how we got to where we got to. So.
Thank you.
I believe this is a technical fix as much as anything.
I'm going to speculate here that the need for the technical fix is because the statute was written to address the economic and social and technology situation that existed at the time it was written, and it needs to be modernized to cover whatever modern day equivalents are of the purpose of the statute originally. Does that seem reasonable as an interpretation? It reminds me of a discussion at a local planning commission where video people used to go to stores to borrow videotapes or video cassettes. You know, that's you'd go to Blockbusters, in other words, or some equivalent. And there was nothing in the statute that discussed it. So the argument was it needed to be regulated like a movie theater. And we didn't think that that didn't pass the sniff test either. It wasn't like a movie theater. But the terminology just didn't exist at the time that code was written. So we're modernizing. Are there any other questions for this panel? Judge Reynolds and those of you who are here, thank you very much for your testimony. There are
thank
no
you
other
very much.
Questions.
for your time.
No one else has signed up to testify. I'm going to close the public. Oh.
We want to hear from revenue.
They didn't sign up.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yep. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2458. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2522.
Hey, Madam Chair, just briefly here, switching gears over to the income tax side of things. House Bill 2522 is creating an income tax credit that's would be available to taxpayers that are purchasing emergency preparedness supplies that are recommended for preparation for a natural disaster by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. The credit is established as the lesser of $100 or the amount spent on those emergency preparedness supplies in the tax year. There is an allotment for the credit to be carried forward for up to 3 years. And it would be applicable for tax years 2020 through 2025.
Thank you. Representative Doherty.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Findlay and Marsh. For the record, I'm Margaret Doherty, and I'm the state rep for House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And I'm here today to discuss House Bill 2522 relating to a tax credit for purchasing emergency preparedness supplies. I'll start first this morning by talking about where the idea came from. Like many of you, I have folks in my district who participate in the local community emergency response team, or CERT, or in Portland they call it NET, the neighborhood emergency teams, to plan for natural disasters and prepare for emergencies that could impact our community and our state. This summer I had the opportunity to attend an event in Tigard to learn more about CERT and all the work that they do. And they made it very, very clear to me that more must be done to make sure that individuals had supplies around for a natural disaster and to bring awareness of the importance of preparing for an emergency, and not only food supplies, but others. That's why I'm here today to ask for your support of 2522. Which would create a tax credit for the purchase of supplies to prepare for a natural disaster as recommended by FEMA. This bill is not groundbreaking or earth-shattering, but it will go a long way to make sure that Oregonians are encouraged to prepare for an emergency. When a devastating natural emergency and natural disaster occurs, there's one certain way to soften the blow, and that's to be prepared. When we face such a disaster, resources and time will be spent saving victims, clearing rubble, trying to get bridges back up, and largely getting the necessary supplies to those drastically affected. If Oregonians prepare for one of these disasters, we can lessen the burden to those risking their lives to save others. This, at its heart, is an investment in safety. By offering a tax credit to Oregonians to purchase these supplies, and it's a $100 tax credit, we are motivating our citizens to elevate the standard of preparedness. If one person has the necessary supplies to save themselves in a natural disaster, it allows responders to go through and save others. So put simply, one person being prepared could easily save the life of another. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Doherty. Like this. Is there a place that I can go and find that list from FEMA? I know it's not in statute because that's going
to
change.
You could probably go to the FEMA list, and also every CERT team, you know, Google Tiger CERT or whatever, actually has a list of what you need. But it was everything from food to tents to
flashlights,
first aid kits, all of water. That kind of thing.
I'm just trying to a quick follow-up comment. I'm just trying to make it make sure I'm clear that it's really usable, so that if this passes, which I think it will, that people can take advantage of it. No, oh, I bought a camper. Oh, that doesn't qualify under the list. So,
right.
So just easy access to the list. So, okay, good.
And Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, on the list it is there, and a lot of the things that are on the list are not things like campers or tents or whatever, but all of the things add up to way over $100 because I have, in fact, it's in my trunk, all of the sort of things that you need, and it's probably about $250 worth. So.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Findlay and Marsh, committee members. For the record, my name is Evan Source. I'm the chief of staff for Representative Paul Evans, who sends his apologies, but he had a standing medical appointment and was not able to attend. So I'm going to read a letter that he wrote on his behalf. HB 2522 represents a critical step forward for our overall statewide resiliency. This measure represents an investment in families across the state of Oregon, especially those families struggling today just to pay the bills at the end of the month. In many ways, this bill represents fairness. It is both an instrument as well as an ornament, substance, and symbol. As you know, for many families, the purchase of a stockpile of life safety equipment, food, and supplies remains a luxury, something beyond their grasp. For it is difficult to justify an investment in foods or supplies for the future when today is uncertain. Today, this measure will not transform the resiliency of our state overnight, but it will demonstrate our recognition of the importance of family preparedness. It would provide a modest incentive of a $100 tax credit for the purchase of critical disaster-related goods. And while this amount is likely far from sufficient for providing the 2 weeks of supplies recommended by the Federal Emergency Management Agency or the Oregon Office of Emergency Management, it will send an important message. It will help make at least a baseline supply a little more possible. As chair of the Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness for the Oregon House of Representatives, I can earnestly believe this measure could and would spark renewed interest in the importance of individual as well as family preparedness. We must do everything possible to ensure we are better prepared for the catastrophes to come. Simply put, the more we prepare before a disaster, the fewer people will die. It's that simple. Unfortunately, we cannot take any action to eliminate the likely loss of life resulting from catastrophic disaster, but together we can reduce its price in lives and property damage. To be successful, we must come together as a community and demonstrate our commitment to enhanced resiliency posture. I ask for your support for this basic but straightforward steps towards greater preparedness. Thank you for your consideration of HB 2522 today. Please let me know if there are simple or specific questions you might have or additional information you might require for positive action of this bill. And then just to add, upon our research of this, there are a number of states who have tax holidays for emergency preparedness credits. So. Supplies. So a lot of the southern states around where they are likely to hit with hurricanes have whole weekends where buying supplies is tax-free. So other states that do have a sales tax waive that for some of this emergency preparedness supplies.
Thank you. Hmm? There are questions. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. So you've just made another good argument for us passing a sales tax so we can have sales tax holidays, which are not within our grasp now. Do you have any idea, obviously we look at this, we have to look at maximum or expected budget impact. Do you have any way, any ideas to predict how many people might take advantage of this? It seems like it's pretty easy if you're filling out your taxes to check to want that $100 tax credit. And obviously, we need to calculate in some ways what the total payout of this might be.
And Representative Nathanson, Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair, Vice Co-Chair Marsh, I can't remember in the bill whether there was a cap on it. But usually in legislation like that, there's some sort of a cap because I couldn't predict how many people would take advantage of it.
How would you? I'm going to ask for a response from LRO, if that's all right. Kyle is in here. Can I ask? I intend to ask for a response.
Oh, yes, Madam Chair. So the credit that's being proposed in 2522 has the credit itself would be limited to $100, but there's not an overall cap on what the credit could be contained in the introduced version. So the supplies are specified based upon FEMA, and then there is going to be rulemaking authority for Department of Revenue to try to determine that list as well, which would help us to understand, because certainly, and I included this in the background of the SMS, some of the things that are on that basic emergency kit, which is just like the most basic list, includes things like batteries, water, and such things that could people probably purchase outside of the kit as well. So there is, yeah, that would be one of the difficulties is trying to determine how narrow we could make the language to tighten the credit specific to emergency kits, so to speak, rather than just I purchase batteries for my remote, those sort of things, and I just include it on my tax return.
Certainly.
Can this is either to you all or to staff. How do we, what kinds of documentation will we ask for?
If you would like me to answer the question, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Findlay and Marsh, you know, to me, it's like everything that you do with any sort of tax thing. If you want to take a tax credit, if you want to take a tax, you know, deduction, you have receipts. And you have receipts that are valid for that year and, you know, where it comes from and everything else. And so you know, I'm not in a rulemaking position, but to me, a very reasonable thing, instead of saying, oh, I just bought this, is to have the receipts. Along with that. I mean, any sort of the tax credits that I have, one tax credit that I do now, and I have the receipt from the state of Oregon or from the Oregon Cultural Trust. And so those are the sort of documentations that would be absolutely necessary.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I'll ask one. I've used the Office of Emergency Management website, and you get referred to a link to the American Red Cross for the list of emergency supplies. So I assume that in rulemaking, they'll sort out who puts what kind of thing on what list. Had you contemplated anything beyond personal immediate supplies, such as dehydrated food, water straws, and so forth? Had you contemplated anything that's a little bit in the area of home preparation? For example, the kit to strap a water heater to a wall, because that's a source of water, fresh water.
Having tools to turn gas off and that kind of thing. Chair Nathanson, Representatives Marsh and Findlay and the rest of the committee, we haven't contemplated exactly what that is. We've kind of just been looking at what the FEMA list is. And to be honest with you, I can't remember whether the FEMA list has those sort of things on there. I know that our CERT teams go through and they not only suggest things like that, but they, a lot of times, they'll hand out the strap that you can put around your water heater and that kind of thing. But that's not something that we have contemplated.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Also signed up to testify, if you don't mind coming up at the same time, it saves a little bit of time, Jody Weiser, Marsha Kelly. And those are the last two names I have signed up for this bill. Is there anyone else who hadn't signed up yet? Thank you.
Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Marsha Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Tax credits. When we seem to have a little bit more money, tax credits keep on coming out of the wall. This is a noble purpose, but would it be better to spend money through the general fund and make sure that low-income people have access to emergency preparedness kits? Because they're the people who will probably not take this tax credit. Number one, they're too busy to pay attention to what earning a living to pay attention to what the legislature has done in the way of tax credits. They normally don't have tax They may go to a tax preparer, but the tax preparer is just doing basic things and not necessarily counseling like a CPA would do for higher income folks. At some point, we need to stop using tax credits as a way of getting around general fund appropriations. It's a noble cause, but what is going to be accomplished? What we need to do is make sure that we spend money on making sure people know about being prepared for emergencies. We can engage community entities in helping this. Let me give you an example. I'm an Episcopal, and we have baskets at convention to raise money for the grants that we give to churches for their activities for the poor and the homeless. St. Mary's in Eugene, for a couple of years, brought an emergency preparedness kit as one of the baskets that people could try to win through a raffle. It was very, very popular, and it also raised awareness that you should be doing this. I would be more happy if we were spending money educating people on preparedness through the general fund than giving tax credits to probably the higher income folks in the state.
And members of the committee. What I have to say is rather similar
your,
to what
your name first,
Jody
please.
Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. What I have to say is really similar to what Marcia has just said, and I would say it for the second bill that you have coming up that's a similar tax credit today. If you believe that helping people get prepared for emergencies or in gardening or food banks, then you should do it through grants and the normal process of allocating the funds of the state, not through tax credit programs. For the most part, the people who advocate tax credits prefer them because it's a 6-year cycle of review rather than a 2-year cycle of review. But your primary responsibilities are reviewed every 2 years when you do a budget. And whether you want to help with emergency supplies or community gardens or food banks is a question that you should address through the budget process. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? And no one else has signed up to testify. So I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2522. And now I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2538.
Okay. Madam Chair, House Bill 2538 is a bill that would create a personal income tax credit, and this would be available to taxpayers that invest in one or more community gardens and or a charitable food bank. It does establish the credit. It's equal to 30% of the amount invested that's greater than $10,000. In a given tax year, and it would be applicable to tax years 2019 through 2024.
Thank you. I have three people signed up to testify, and I don't see a legislator in the room to call up first. So first, Evan Source, please.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Finley and Marsh, committee members. Again, my name for the record is Evan Source. I'm the Chief of Staff for Representative Paul Evans, who sends his apologies, but is at a medical appointment. And I'm going to read a letter that he wrote on behalf in support of HB 2538. HB 2538 is offered for your consideration as dual purpose utility to encourage accelerated growth in fresh produce for our regional food banks, as well as an investment in our resiliency posture. The goal is simple: encouraging people with available space to enter into partnerships that can significantly increase the amount of food grown within our state borders. It is based upon a belief that many homeowners who might otherwise spend money and time maintaining lawns and/or landscaping may well be interested in a modest financial incentive associated with allowing their lawn space to be optimized to produce food for the needy within our own communities. During World War II, victory gardens sprouted up across our country. I believe we can combat hunger with a grassroots community-based lawn-to-garden strategic investment. If passed, this measure would provide our food banks with another tool for their toolbox. Imagine a community where schools integrate science, education, and practical learning opportunities provided by added space for community gardens. With the appropriate amount of planning, we can emphasize areas near schools and make stewardship of our natural world and hunger relief a lifelong lesson for our students. This bill provides a significant value for a minimal cost. It can facilitate a rethinking of the best use of available space. It might facilitate a strengthening of relationships within community. And if given the opportunity, it will vastly expand the availability of fresh, locally grown produce for our families, friends, and neighbors who are struggling. Together, we can promote a new way of thinking about our privately owned residential spaces. Thank you for your consideration of HB 2538 today. Please let me know if there are specific questions you might have or additional information you might require. Thank you for your time. Thank
you. Questions? Representative Rushkin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming to testify. So I'm just reading through Section 2 of the bill, trying to understand it. So if I were to donate $30,000 to my local food bank, it says the taxpayer who invests more than $10,000 the credit is calculated by subtracting $10,000. So I have $30,000, I subtract 10, I get to 20, and then I multiply that result by 30%, which gets me to, I think, $600. So would that be the amount of my tax credit then? Maybe it's $6,000. Yeah.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, I would have to do the math on that.
Yeah.
Before telling you an answer, 6,000, yeah, I don't want to lie to you.
Yeah. I was thinking three or six. Oh, yeah, $6,000. So, yeah. Okay, but that's kind of the flow of how this works.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and again, Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, the goal is to incentivize folks who have large land spaces. In our district, there are a number of folks who have large properties who, upon talking about, hunger in our community and food deserts, we basically started a conversation about, would it be interesting to you if you had an incentive, would you grow more food in on your property for the community food banks? And they were very interested in the idea of growing food that goes directly to feed folks in their community. So
just to follow up, if I could. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it says a taxpayer who invests. So I guess I want to know what the word invests mean. Is that I donate $30,000 to the food bank, or I invest in infrastructure so they can buy a truck so they can deliver food, or do you have an idea of maybe LRO has a better idea what invests means in this situation?
What? It's in the
staff. Is it? Okay.
Representative Findlay, were you pointing out that the preliminary staff measure summary does have some guidance for us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The preliminary staff summary has Merriam-Webster definition of invest.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. Is there anything, or I don't see anything in the bill, I wonder if you've thought about trying to tie those investments to production? If you're on the food bank side, it's essentially a donation to a nonprofit, so you already have some deductibility around that donation. So we'd have to look at the whatever duplication you're getting there. In a community garden, I understand that, or if a swath of land, as you've described, might not be under a nonprofit ownership. But if the intent is to produce food, it seems like maybe there should be something in there that actually ties the investment to production and to donation.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, I will definitely take your comments back to the representative and see what we can do to address that issue in the bill.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Two more people are signed up to testify. Seems like you're comfortable coming up at the same time, please. Jody Weiser, Marcia Kelly.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly. I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I feel like the Grinch today. but again, a good cause can be done different ways. People who give money to food banks are a range of people, but when you're talking in the range of 10,000, you're talking about, again, higher income Oregonians. An example, it says invest in a community garden. Our church has a community garden, and we spent probably about $1,000, maybe $1,500, to provide some fencing, some poles, the beds. We've gotten a lot of things donated, chips from people who cut trees down, and then they dump the chips on our property so we can take care of it. Tax credits are not the way to incent good behavior. Good behavior is being part of the community and making those investments. And tax credits just keep on taking money away from the general fund for which we have lots of purposes. And if it's a good purpose and we should spend money on community gardens, then we should give grants to communities for community gardens rather than giving tax credits to, basically, I would submit high-income folks or businesses.
Thank you. Any questions?
And maybe you're not the right person to answer this, but when we have general fund expenditures, we can do audits and determine outcomes. And how does that work for tax credits? Are we able to see more specifically the impacts and what those outcomes are and the individuals that were benefited from it, the demographics data and the poverty level data?
About achieving the purpose of the tax credit?
Just to that point, Rep. Hernandez, we do have a tax credit report that LRO is required to write, and we produce that prior to a tax credit that would be sunsetting. So in terms of a newly created tax credit, you'd be getting a report in the year prior to its sunset, so this would be probably about 2023 for this one, on exactly those type of things. So that gives us a chance to get the data as well on who's been claiming it and who are the beneficiaries and that sort of information.
Thank you.
I would submit that, excuse me, Chair Nathanson, Representative Hernandez, I would submit that there's a likelihood that they might find some community gardens that have been established and say, well, we've gotten some community gardens established, so it looks like the tax credit is working. Some of the looks at the tax credits are not terribly thorough. And if we had a thorough administration of the tax credit would cost a lot more money because we would spend time looking at just those same things. That's one of the reasons why we think a general purpose appropriation, which I know we do to the Oregon Food Bank, would be better than this tax credit.
All right. Thank you very much. And I think we're getting the signal that there's no one left to testify. I am closing the public hearing on House Bill 2538. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2575.
Okay, Madam Chair, House Bill 2575 is another tax credit bill, so it's creating an income tax credit. In this case, it's available to an owner or operator of a brownfield property that incurs specified eligible costs for removal or remedial action of that brownfield property. The specifications for the credit are equal to 50% of the eligible costs in the tax year, up to $1 million for a brownfield property. And there's a provision for an additional credit of 25% of the eligible costs if the property owner operator follows specified enhancement actions that are specified in statute as well. They can get that additional 25%. The credit can be carried forward for up to 5 tax years. There is transferability of the credit provisions in there. So a credit could be transferred to another taxpayer. And it would be applicable tax years 2020 through 2025.
Thank you. For the first panel, Representative McCune, Randy Tucker, Seth Otto. Representative McCune.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Co-Vice Chairs Marsh and Finley, members of the committee. My name is Kati McCune, and I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast, Coos Bay to Yahats. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today in support of House Bill 2575. And you've heard basically what this bill does. It creates a tax credit for the cleanup of contaminated sites known as brownfields. I've been pleased to work with the Oregon Brownfields Coalition since it first came into existence in 2015. And been an advocate for the policies and funding solutions to help get these sites cleaned up and back into productive use. In 2015, when I chaired the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development, the committee introduced the original version of this bill, which was House Bill 2289, and we sent it down to your committee with a due pass recommendation. At the time, the coalition decided to concentrate on some lower-hanging fruit around brownfields, and in fact, it did pass other legislation to help clean up brownfields in that session. In 2016, I chief co-sponsored House Bill 4084 along with former Representative John Davis, who at that time was a member of this committee. House Bill 4084 authorized local governments to provide property tax incentives for the cleanup and redevelopment of contaminated sites. I'm pleased and thrilled to report that last year, Marion County became the first jurisdiction in the state to pass an ordinance implementing that property tax incentive. And the city of Portland has developed an ordinance of their own that I anticipate they will enact soon. As I noted, the bill before you today in 2575 would create a state income tax credit to support brownfield cleanup. Since my committee first introduced legislation in 2015, a lot of work has been done and is still being done to develop this concept and provide analytical support for it. And I will let my my good friends of the Brownfield Coalition go into the details with you once I have this introduction complete. Mr. Tucker and Mr. Otto are interested and ready to present an analysis for you that's underway, but I want to provide a couple of high points of the bill. And you've heard the basics of it. It provides a tax credit for half of the cost directly associated with cleaning up a contaminated property, up to the per project cap that's specified in the bill. There's also an overall cap on the total amount of credits that can be awarded in each year. It creates opportunities for increasing the tax credit if cleanup is conducted or a property is used in certain ways that have further benefit to the community. For example, cleanup of a high poverty census tract in a high poverty census tract, a cleanup using minority or women-owned contractors, or a commitment to use the land to build affordable housing, which obviously is a topic of great concern across the state this particular session and into the future, or keep the property in an industrial zone. House Bill 2575 will protect environmental concerns, of course, by requiring that any cleanup is conducted under the oversight of the DEQ and by prohibiting anyone who caused or contributed to the contamination from claiming a tax credit. And finally, very importantly, the bill is designed to ensure that tax credits don't all get snapped up by the sharp lawyers who may reside in Mr. Tucker's district. The reason I am interested in brownfield development and the way we have constructed these bills over the last number of years has to do with this is ecumenical across the state. It has an urban and a rural nexus. It's just important in the rural communities of Oregon as it is in the metro area. And I find that very enticing to those of us who care about development in rural communities. And as was noted by staff, it also reserves 25% of the credits for cleanups in rural communities, and 25% of the money would be designated for distressed communities. Again, the ecumenical nature of how this bill was drafted, I think, is critically important for those of us who look to all corners of the state. I want to thank you for your willingness to consider the House bill. I think this is just the next step in the evolution of what we're trying to do to clean up these blighted properties, allow economic development to occur in all corners of the state. And I am going to turn the next segment over to the gentlemen to my left and right who have worked on the details of this and are here to answer any questions that you might have regarding the importance of this significant bill that's before you today.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Marsh and Findlay, and members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, and I'm appearing before you in that capacity as well as my capacity as the sort of de facto coordinator of the Oregon Brownfields Coalition. Speaking for the coalition, though the coalition itself doesn't take positions on legislation, just the individual members. The bill before you today, as Representative McEwen has already said, addresses a problem that affects communities across our state. Thousands of properties of all sizes and circumstances where development is prevented or constrained by environmental contamination. These properties are as different as the communities in which they are located, and there's not a single solution that can address all of them. There are many different typologies of these properties. There's the largest amount of acreage is industrial, but the largest number of sites are commercial or residential, smaller commercial and residential sites. These properties often sit vacant for years, contributing virtually nothing to local tax rolls while continuing to blight local communities, degrading property values, and posing risks to residents and the environment. So after years of ad hoc efforts to address this issue in the legislature, back in about in 2014, a number of people started meeting to try to come up with a more systematic approach. Some of my colleagues at Metro coordinated those first meetings, and more people wanted to attend. And suddenly we had the makings of a coalition. And when they started talking about legislation, that's when they called me in and said, you know, that's your job, Randy. Come work with us. So we developed at that time a legislative agenda that was focused on a number of issues that we felt were high impact and also high political feasibility. And I'm pleased to report, as Representative McEwen already reported, that many of those bills have already been passed, or two bills plus some work in the budget that has been successful. The issue that we identified that was high impact but more difficult politically was this one that's before you today in House Bill 2575, a tax credit. I've sort of buried you with submitted materials, and I'm just going to tell you what I've given you, and maybe a couple of them might be useful up on the screen. It's not as bad as it looks. There's this document, which is electronically submitted. It's a brochure from Business Oregon, and I should say on the record, Business Oregon is not supporting or opposing this bill, but this is general information on brownfields, and I would call your attention when you look at it to the map in the middle that shows the statewide nature of the problem, and then there's a page here that talks about the economic impact of brownfield cleanup, and then the back page, which discusses what other states have done, including this is the part about a tax credit that other states have implemented. There's a one-pager from the Brownfields Coalition, which I call your attention to because it lists the members of the Brownfields Coalition down here. We have people from the public and the private and the nonprofit sector that are interested in making progress on this issue. And then there are three documents that were developed by Legislative Revenue Office in 2016. Representative McEwen mentioned Representative Davis. Representative Davis at that time requested some analysis from LRO. And so I will note those are 3 years old now, or 2.5 years old, but they give you a pretty good overview of what other states are doing. And then the LRO staffer at the time that pulled that together sort of projected, based on what other states do, what the revenue impact might be to Oregon of a brownfields tax credit. From what I can tell, that work did not assume an annual cap on the total amount of tax credits, and so it projected a much higher amount of revenue impact than what we're requesting today. We've put a cap in the bill that's several times lower than that overall demand, but it suggests that there's a healthy demand for a tool like this in the state. Then there's also this document that LRO produced at that time. It's useful verbally what some other states are doing, as well as laying out some of the policy questions on the back that we have tried to address in various ways in the legislation. So finally, there's this document, which is a bulleted summary of this bill before you today. I would note that the bill as introduced is an early draft, and there's already a dash one that's a gut and stuff, and that's being worked on, and there will be some dash higher number amendment that we'll bring before you when we actually want to walk through the provisions of the bill more detail. We've also been working with the Department of Revenue to make sure that we address technical issues in the bill. But this bulleted summary remains accurate as far as the sort of policy decisions that we've made so far in the coalition. And obviously, we're happy to work with you on specifics of what we're suggesting here. I'll just mention a couple of things. As Rep. McEwen said, there is a per project cap in the bill that, as we've drafted it, it's $500,000 or 50% of your eligible cleanup costs, whichever is less. And then you can get an additional 25% if you do things that are of further benefit to the community beyond just the benefit of the brownfield cleanup itself. Construction of affordable housing, use of minority contractors, cleanup in they're posted. I don't have to read through it. The carry forward and transferability and clawback provisions we're trying to make as standard as possible to the way tax credits are done currently. And I will just mention we've also put an $8 million annual cap, and obviously we'll work with you on any number that is appropriate given your constraints. And then finally, as Representative McEwen mentioned, we've reserved 25% of the overall tax credit for distressed communities and 25% for rural communities. Both of those have statutory definitions, and those would be reserved for the first half of the year. And if they aren't claimed, then that money would go back into the general pot. But we want to make sure that it's not all the benefit of this program is not all concentrated in the most populated and highest property value areas of the state, at least give an opportunity for other areas to participate. I'll stop there, and I will let Seth talk about some work we're doing to try to demonstrate the return on investment that this tax credit would have.
Thank you. And since we are now running short of time, I hope you can get across your main message in 2 to 3 minutes, because okay. We have two other persons signed up to testify, and we have at least one question.
I can wait till later, so I can visit with him later, too. Okay.
Members of the committee, good morning. My name is Seth Otto. I'm with the consulting firm Mall Foster Longy. I have been working with the Oregon Brownfield Coalition since its inception, and prior to that with many of the agencies that form the coalition. My task for the coalition and today is to analyze the scale of brownfields in the state of Oregon, their impact on our communities, and to measure return on investment from direct state and other public sector investments into redeveloping these properties. I do have a presentation. I will go quickly, and we can leave it if we need to, and I'm happy to answer any questions. It's important to note that brownfields are a statewide issue. They impact every community that we live in, every legislative district. They're found in small towns and major metropolitan areas. It's not just a Portland problem. Of the 5,000 sites that were in 2012 in DEQ's cleanup program, the majority of them were not in the Portland area, and they continue to be a problem in our smaller communities. Since 1988, DEQ has maintained a database of environmentally contaminated sites in our state. That database has grown by approximately 180 sites annually. They're closing those out at a rate of about 55 a year. So you can see there's a growing delta between sites that are coming into the program and sites that are being resolved. Why should the state care? Why should we invest in brownfields? That's a big question to resolve here, and part of the reason that we're considering a tax credit. Existing programs so far, so this is Business Oregon and DEQ specifically, have invested approximately $15 million over the last 23 years in different programs. And for every dollar that's been invested, we found that approximately 116 additional dollars have been leveraged, and that's both public and private sector money. That's accounted for 2,600 acres of brownfield properties redeveloped, accounting for 8,900 new jobs. Those 8,900 jobs have resulted in nearly $20 million annually in property taxes and just over $10 million annually. I'm sorry, I have my numbers inversed. The point being that there's a significant return that these programs have paid for themselves handily over the years that they've been active. In 2012, along with Metro, we analyzed some best practices nationally for brownfield policy. Many of those have actually been enacted already, which is a testament to the state legislature and their intent to take this problem seriously. One of the last remaining high priority public policies is the remediation tax credit. This is something that's worked quite handily in other states around the nation, and we understand would have a significant impact here in Oregon. In fact, for $1 million invested, you have an annual personal income tax return of $300,000. So again, approximately maybe a three-year return on investment for a brownfield tax credit. This is in the metro area. The dollars are a little bit different when you go statewide, understandably, but it still shows a positive return. Again, we understand that no single policy will address brownfields. They come in different shapes and are, you know, in various different communities and have various different impacts. But those that require some immediate upfront investment can be flipped, as we say, into feasibility fairly easily through something like a brownfield tax credit. Again, the state has already enacted some of the previous recommendations in the tax abatement. Land bank authority has been granted, and the state's brownfield cleanup fund has been capitalized, and I believe there's a request again this year, and that money is being put into good use. So what are we doing right now? We are currently undergoing an evaluation of the state inventory of brownfield sites. Where are they located? What are the markets they exist in? What types of properties are most impacted? And we'll be modeling the impact of a remediation tax credit to look at jobs produced, housing units, and the property and income tax that's generated from redevelopment of those properties.
Thank you.
And we expect to have results this month, a timely fashion,
yes,
for your consideration.
Thank you. Committee, I, for one, can stay 7 minutes. Are any of you able to stay a few minutes beyond 9:45 to hear the remaining testimony?
Two or three. Yeah. Supposed to be somewhere.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to hear now. Senator Frederick, you've joined us, and I have three other persons signed up to testify, and we must end by no later than 10 till.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. I'm Lou Frederick, Senator from District 22, that's north and northeast Portland. And this has been a long-running issue of mine and concern of mine. I just wanted to insert something that you probably have not heard about because I didn't hear about it until last spring. I walked into a class at Baker High School, Baker Technical Institute, and they started to talk about this particular class. The school, the district, had been given a plot of land, discovered that it was a brownfield. The students decided to take a look at the brownfield and figure out what that meant. When they figured it out, they found out, they went and researched how to clean it up. They got somebody else to clean it up, but they managed to get it cleaned up, and then they sold it. And they bought another brownfield. And they started to clean up the brownfields in Baker City. And they're doing their, it is an aspect of this that we never expected. And when I was told this story, I floated about 5 feet off the ground because one of the first bills that I passed in this Capitol dealt with brownfield cleanup issues, because we had in my district 147 of them, and we're beginning to start to slowly clean them up. We have them in every one of your districts, but I never expected that this would be and have an impact at the educational level, at a career situation, because there are kids in Baker City who now know how to clean these up, and they now know how to make it better for their community. I would encourage you to support this bill. It is something that it's another step in cleaning up some of the contaminated sites we have around the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Questions? Thank you.
I just want to thank the senator, because I was at that meeting, and it's a great session. Thank you.
Great. Mr. Salinger, please.
Uh,
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Bob Solinger, and I'm the Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland. We are a member of the Oregon Brownfields Coalition, and we are supportive of this legislation. We've been participating for the last several years, and we're impressed with the work that the coalition has done and how much this legislation has evolved over the years. I have submitted written comments that go into greater detail. We do think this is important legislation. There are over 20,000 acres of brownfields in the state of Oregon, we have over 900 in the city of Portland. There is some work that still needs to be done, though. I know the Brownfields Coalition is committed to continuing to work on this bill. I just want to flag a couple of things today. The size of the credit, we want to make sure that it really is scaled appropriately so that it incentivizes people who would otherwise not clean up to do so, but so that it doesn't give people an unnecessary windfall either. Eligibility, we want to make sure that the only sites that are eligible are ones that are not subject to a mandatory cleanup requirement. If you're already required to clean up your site and you're being enforced against, there's no reason to provide a tax credit for that. So make sure that they go to sites that are, excuse me, that truly are voluntary cleanups. There are escalators that allow you to get a larger tax credit if you provide public benefits. We think that work is very, very important in that component, but it does need a little bit more fine-tuning. I know the coalition is committed to doing that. And finally, equitable distribution of the tax credit. It was mentioned earlier that the sharp lawyers in Portland might grab all the money for the city of Portland. We're concerned about that, but we're also concerned about making sure that the big corporate lawyers in Portland don't grab it from the smaller entities as well within Portland. So making sure that smaller entities are able to compete well against big corporations that may have a lot more firepower on these issues. So we'll continue to work on this with the coalition. We appreciate your consideration of our comments today.
Thank you for being here with us and for submitting the written testimony.
Absolutely.
Jody Weiser and Marcia Kelly.
Gee, I wonder what they're going to say. For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So I have submitted some testimony, the main body of which is a listing of all the different programs and different departments that have received federal and state funding to address brownfields. We have recently added two tax credit programs, or two programs, a land trust program and a tax credit program for brownfields. So those things have been poorly used, and so there's no evaluation of those. And we wonder why the best solution isn't to put, if we need more money in the programs that we've funded with up to $6.5 million of money for revolving loans and grants, where a department is paying attention to how the money is being used. If there is an emptiness in those funds now, 2 years ago, there was still $4 million left, then why isn't that the best approach? Because otherwise, you basically have private owners with lawyers self-identifying, we need this money. And if they're going to build on MLK, a new high-rise apartment building that's or office complex or industrial site or whatever they're going to build there, they're going to build it. You see it happening right now. We don't need to help them with the cost by giving them a tax credit that could cover up to 100% cost of remediating a problem. And they already got that land for low price because it had a brownfield. And so I think that if you do it through the grant and loan program available through our departments, you actually have the public eye looking at the public good, and that's a much better approach for us to use. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Killen. I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, and I'm going to reserve my comments until I see the Dash 1 amendments. However, I would have one comment, and that's that I think that at some point, making sure that we don't stack tax credit upon tax credit upon tax credit would be worthwhile. And the minute that someone said identifying low-income census tracts, I went immediately to the opportunity zones issues and the things that are affiliated with that. That seems to be the new market tax credit program, which in many cases has been abused and utilized for funding things that would have been funded otherwise.
Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you all for being here, for your testimony. Thank you, committee, for staying. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2575, and we are adjourned.